Hello there, now Lelim. We begin Parshas Nasam Yirtzeh Hashem. We also would like to thank our great technician here in the studio, Mrs. Libby Bamzer. Our shir is Lila Nishus Rachaleh Basra Chaim Si Alah Shalom. I told you for quite a number of times, maybe too many times already, that we've had quite a great difficulty because our mandate is to tell the story of the Parsha. And Parsha after Parsha, there was no storyline. It was just mitzvos, it was concepts. Baruch Hashem, we come back to a story. So we're going to give an overview and a beginning and an introduction and maybe a little too much of this, but here's the concept. Something I've spoken about very often, which is how a small thing can be very significant. One can never underestimate the power of something small, because something small can become truly great. We'll see this in our Parsha, based on a very interesting concept said by Rabbi Lev. The rabbi said the following statement: Ein Kosh Baruch Hu knows saying, Gdula la'adam achabot kehu bin davar katan. God never works greatest to an individual until he first tests him on the small matter, on the pitch of kiss, if you will. And it's the small things that truly make something great. The motto of Boy Scouts is, do a good turn daily. How a small thing, that makes you into a more ethical and a moral person. Not that we have to bring a proof from the Boy Scouts. We have this in the Torah itself. How did Moshe Rabbeinu become the leader of our people? I assume you're all familiar with the Medrash, which teaches that he was a shepherd, and one day he was chagrined because a sheep was missing. He found the sheep far away at the brook drinking water, and he felt so chagrined. Here he was, supposed to be the shepherd for the flock, and one sheep had strayed off because it was thirsty. He had not tended properly to the sheep. He put the shepherd on his shoulder and carried him back. That was a loving shepherd. God said, I want this man to be the shepherd of my flock, to be the leader of the Jewish nation. That's what it says in the Medrash. But Chazal say, this is of course based on what it says in the Torah, one day Moshe was walking in the wilderness. He sees a bush which is burning, yet it's not consumed. Asur and I shall go out of my way to see this godly sight. How much did he go out of his way to see the godly sight? Polemic in the Talmud. Rav Yochanan says he went three steps out of his way. Just three little steps. Says Reish Lakish, he turned his neck. It was the smallest of acts. But because he went out of his way to show something godly, that depicts greatness. I hasten to mention, you tell your husband, you know, there's a bush which is burning, but it's not consumed. Okay, honey, but I got to go to work. You call the fire department. I got to run out of your way for something small, for something great. That depicts greatness. For that, Moshe became the leader of our people. Likewise, Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh, she went out to the water to bathe. And she sees a baby far away in the water. That was Moshe Rabbeinu. She stretches out her hand. Now, wasn't that a silly thing to do? The baby was so far away, and the Chazal teacher hand elongated and outstretched. And she managed to pull him in. How one small thing can be so great. That's a great lesson. How something small can be significant. Why is it that God created flowers? Said Rabbi Victor Miller, to make people smile and chuckle. And it's not little us, it's small, it's big, little us. We can be something godlike. You get someone to smile, to grin, be happy. That small deed is very significant. I don't know about you, but in our home, certainly before Shabbos, there's always a great rush, and the decibel levels get a little bit higher. And I must tell you, I've traveled a lot, and I've been over people's homes where Friday afternoon, the carpet is vacuumed, they're sitting on the poolside, you know, dropping grapes in their mouths, sipping an iced tea with a lemon over it, and everything is relaxed. Many homes, it's not that way. I can relate better to homes where it is not that way. And yet, no matter what rush you are in, if you can have the table set before the guests arrive, kishulchan arech, that's what God did for us. For Adam and Chava, for Adam and Eve were invited into the world, God set the table. Trees and grass and clouds and water, He prepared for them. So this smallest act, I'm waiting for you, I crave your arrival, I care about my guests, that small act is very significant. That's doing something godlike. And I think on other occasions we mentioned how this was the idea of Slobodka. Slobodka taught how small things can be significant. The motto of Slobodka was, Gadlut Adam. You are so significant, so grand, so chivalrous. How can you do something inappropriate if you knew what you were? And therefore, something small cannot be significant. Every small thing can be very significant. Rabbi Shlomo Salanter, indeed all the Muslim personalities, it seems to be a dominant theme how they recognize how small acts be significant. Perhaps the most famous statement Rabbi Shlomo Salanter ever made was, one evening he was passing by a cobbler. I do not know the verb, but he was cobbling, he was shoemaking. And he went over to the cobbler, he went to the shop, and he, how can you be working? There's no illumination. And the cobbler pointed to the candle and he said, ironically, of course, every Israeli school child knows this by heart, I suspect the Kabbalah did not say it in Hebrew, Kol zman shener dolek efshar od l'taken. As long as the candle is still burning, it's still possible to rectify and repair. In other words, as long as the neshama is still kicking, as long as you're still alive, every act can be significant. Every act can be significant. Okay, that was merely an introduction. Okay, so we have in our Parsha, this I heard, it's based on a Sparta in the beginning of the Parsha that was so beautifully elaborated by Rabbi Lev in Tafshin Mem Zayin, meaning 22 years ago. And the concept is the following. The Parsha begins, and then we'll go see things inside. It begins, it's the longest Parsha, Parshas Maso, I'll get you later on in our class, how many psukim there are and why it's so long. It begins by saying, Noso es rosh b'nei Gershon gam hein. So, Gershon, this deal is the following. That gam hein is that Gershon, they are the brothers of Kahas, and we had them in the census that was mentioned earlier, in the earlier, last week's Parsha. So Kahas carried the most sacred elements of the tabernacle, and the Bnei Gershon, Gershon is carrying things that are far less sacred than their brother Kahas. Now, telling them, Naso Gamhem, them as well, the Torah is making the point that everything is necessary for the tabernacle. And each thing, be it very holy, mega holy, or just moderately holy, each thing is significant and has a role in the service, and everything should be done with equal joy. And there's an implied message over here that Rav Moshe Feinstein points out, which is some people can afford to contribute large amounts, and some people can afford to contribute much smaller amounts. Lest the person believe and get discouraged that what is my small contribution when the other person is giving millions and millions and I'm giving just pennies, learn a lesson from Bnei Gershom. Learn a lesson from Parshas Noso. Everyone is important. Learn also that everyone has a role in Torah. Even if you can't learn like someone who's very diligent and very clever, you also have a part. Learn a lesson from Meir Shem. Everyone has a part. So the Sparno says, we see in the largest Parsha these lessons. You're also important. Then a Parsha teaches us, Shituach Tameim, Shiluch Tameim, you must send out the impure people from the camp. Now, how does someone become impure? Just a little exposure to blood, or someone touches a corpse, and they have to be sent out. Now, you would think, what in the world? Why is that such a big deal? One little touching, what difference does that make? And the answer is that one little exposure to impurity can contaminate the entire Jewish nation. It is significant. Send them out. And then we have in our Parsha Birkas Kohanim, Yivrech Hashem Yishmerecha. Now, it's an amazing thing. The Kohanim get up, they mumble a few blessings, and all of a sudden, the floodgates of blessing come pouring upon the Jewish people. How can a few words do it? The answer is God only wants you to do one small step. By saying a few words, it can open up the floodgates of blessing. We have Chanukat HaMizbeach. Every single Nasi brought a small little thing. All these small things teach the lesson of the magnitude of small acts, which is found in the largest Parsha in the Torah. Okay. So, we didn't have here, I mentioned also, is that, we'll get to in just a moment, we have also our Sota. Sota is a very dominant theme in our Parsha. This is the wayward wife. What's the story of a Sota? Well, let's do this in detail. If a woman acted in a manner which was unseemly, and this gives her husband reason to suspect, meaning good reason to suspect, that her behavior was not faithful, but we have no proof one way or the other, being she's either guilty or innocent. There is no proof. So what the Torah does is it gives a miraculous process to determine if this woman has been a faithful wife and her fidelity is intact. Now, if she had in fact sinned, she will die and so will her illicit lover. If in fact she was faithful, then things which did not go well for before will now go much better. Before she gave babies that were discolored, that were unshapely, all of a sudden now her babies will be very, very beautiful and attractive. Now the hope is the fear of imminent death if she was not faithful, and she'll have to drink this potion which will cause a horrific scene right there on the temple floor of her hips expanding and her belly puncturing, horrible scene. The way to avoid this will be to admit her guilt. And if she confesses, what she'll have to do is offer the marriage will be terminated. It'll end in divorce, but there'll be no other penalty to her. Because there's no proof that she was guilty or not. So if she just confesses, then with that alone, she will be exonerated from her crime. Now, the Torah uses two terms to emphasize the sanctity and the purity of the marital relationship. Her unfaithfulness is called mi'ilah, which means treachery. We find the very same expression regarding trespassing with temple property. It means a great defilement of sanctity. The other expression is nitma, she becomes defiled. And this is the antithesis of purity, and marriage is supposed to be the resource of sanctity. If a home doesn't have purity, then we're left with impurity. And we need to have a sacred relationship, and that will be ensured faithfulness and the purity between the partners. So what happens is that if she is accused, witnesses saw her go into a room for a lengthy enough amount of period of time where she could have committed sin with another man, and she had been warned in advance, and yet she still does this, and yet we have no witnesses that saw her committing a crime. There's only a suspicion. We don't know if she's guilty. We do not know if she's innocent. We don't know if she's wrongly accused or not. So to avoid this grotesque death, there's only one procedure, and that's a miracle. The miracle is that in the time of the temple, because afterwards they felt they were not righteous enough to do this and the procedure was curtailed, the idea was twofold. To punish adultery, which would uproot morality, and to try and make a foster relationship between husband and wife. Now, there's a deep psychological truth here, which is that if a husband comes to suspect his wife, he will not even trust the court. The court says, no, she's innocent. But what happens is we invoke a miracle. God's holy, ineffable name is erased, placed into a potion which she will drink. If in fact she's guilty, then she'll have this grotesque death. If she's not guilty, nothing will happen at all. Things will actually improve. It's only God's testimony, and God will allow his name to be erased for this procedure, to put a suspicious husband's mind at ease. So explains Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. And then we have the concept of a Nazir. A Nazir is a Nazirite, and we'll go into the laws in just a moment, who must abstain from wine, any grape products. He cannot contaminate himself to a corpse, and he may not cut his hair for the period of his Nazirite period. And the Gemara says the following: If you see a sota bikilkula, if you see a woman who is suspect of being unfaithful, and you see her drinking this potion, and then having this rupture in the temple floor, this horrific, grotesque death, then the first thing you should do is right away take upon yourself to be a Nazir, to become a Nazirite. Why is that? So I think the way Rav Dessler explains this is that emotions overcome a person. Meaning, you can see something and not realize how a small thing can have a great impact on your soul, on your psychology, on your psyche. One reaction would be, you see this horrible death and you think to yourself, it's terrible. Or you could think to yourself, and there are plenty of cynics out there, you could think to yourself, listen, such a horrible sin, she must have really enjoyed herself to undergo something so terrible at the end. Lest you have this horrible, cynical comment, she must have enjoyed herself right away, take upon yourself to be a Nazir. Also said as well is that if a person, to go to Jerusalem, throughout all the land of Israel, there were signs how to go to a city of refuge. Yet there were no signs how to get to Jerusalem. Why are the signs how to get the city of refuge? So the simple interpretation is a person has killed accidentally, not intentionally, better term, not unintentionally. He's killed through his negligence, but not intentionally. So this person now must run to a city of refuge, lest the redeemers of blood, the relatives of the deceased, come and kill this person in revenge. He'll be safe in the cities of refuge. And there's no time, you're rushing, you're chopping wood in the forest, and the head of the axe comes off, it kills someone. So if you start asking directions, how do I get to a city of refuge, the relatives who are right there could come after you, you'll be dead meat. Therefore, throughout all the land of Israel, at every junction, There's a sign how to get to Ramot, how to get to Gilad, how to get to Betzer, one of the cities of refuge. There's no time to wait. That's one interpretation, the simple interpretation. Said Rav Dessler, what's going to happen? You're going to come running and you say, tell me, how do I get to Betzer? Betzer, this man must have killed. Well, you go up the hill, go to the left, keep on going, that's where it is. Someone else comes running and says, tell me, how do I get to Betzer? Go up the hill, go to the left. Well, and one person, now normally, what should be your exposure to if you encounter someone who's killed? It should be revulsion, ill. But time after time, people come, they say, how do I get to Betzer? So after a while, they seem like decent people, normal people, and you give directions. There's a polemic in educators regarding the violence on television. One school says like this. One school is that, you know, your kid brother comes into your room, takes your notebooks, he rips them up, you're so frustrated, but then when you see the rat-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta on TV, it lets off steam. The other more dominant school is, by the time a child's reached the age of 7, he has seen tens of thousands of murders, violent crimes on TV, and people mimic the crimes which they see. Therefore, what we want to do is keep a person's exposure away from this. I once was teaching this in a class so many trillion years ago, and a woman told me, this was in the Vayu Shalayim, a woman told me that she was a social worker, and she worked in a maximum security prison. She said, hey Bill, how are you doing today? And this guy was a murderer. And she didn't have revulsion. She was so exposed every day, she encountered such people. She didn't have revulsion. The Torah wants to make sure you maintain and you safeguard your sensitivities, and therefore if you see someone who has just committed a crime, you should be repulsed. Not say, hey, just go up, follow the signs. No, on the contrary, there's signs to keep a person not exposed to this. Okay, so the laws of the Nozer are that there's two restrictions. He cannot have grape products, he cannot cannot contaminate himself to a corpse, and he may not cut his hair. After the period of being a Nozer is concluded, he must bring three sacrifices. Why must he bring a sacrifice? He did something which seems very holy. So the Gemara says the reason he must bring a sacrifice is because he withheld himself of a pleasure of this world. He denied himself, he deprived himself of wine products, which is a pleasure which God produced, and you have no right to deprive yourself of a pleasure of this world. So the Gemara asks the Kasha, the Gemara says, Tosfos asks, if that's the case, if you say he must bring a sacrifice because he's denied himself of a pleasure, why then, pray tell, if you see a Saita Bekilkula, an unfaithful wife, and having this horrific, grotesque death, why must you then accept upon yourself to be a Nazirite? We said it's not a good thing. So the Pshat says, Tosfos, the following, that the Katkhila preferably you should not accept upon yourself to become a Nazir because you're going to deprive yourself of the pleasure of this world. However, if a person sees how a person overuses drinking wine, it could result in immorality, people becoming unfaithful to them, breaking their marriage sanctity, then right away you must make a reaction. And this barrier against improper behavior outweighs the drawback of withholding from wine. True, one should not deprive oneself, but you have to be always careful to guide yourself and to make barriers and fences not to violate. That's even more important than depriving yourself of a pleasure. Okay, now let's just go to the Birkas Kohanim, and then we'll say one more African parsha, the priestly blessing, Yerecha Shem Yishmerecha. Let's find that. Here we go. This you'll find in towards the end of the sixth chapter of Bamidbar. It goes like this. So the first of the three blessings, this is rather well known, these are the blessings, Yivrech Hashem Yishmerecha, God should bless you and guard you. So if you're talking the blessing, what needs to be guarded is something which is physical. So spiritual blessings are always protected by God Himself, but a physical blessing, you acquire a new home, a new car, your stocks go up, whatever it may be that you have, which is a physical blessing, it's here today, could be gone tomorrow. This requires a special blessing that you be able to maintain the blessing, to safeguard you. It's a blessing only that God can guarantee. In other words, if a king sends a huge gift, this is what Rashi says, the servant cannot guarantee against any danger. If robbers come and take it away, what good does it help to the recipient? By the very nature, physical blessings are fragile. Because one cannot govern one's health, one's business conditions, and We ask therefore that God should bless you with wealth and protect you, so that the money will enable you, says the Medrash Rabbah, enable you to perform mitzvos. And we've learned that the best way to protect a physical thing is to donate to a spiritual thing. As the Gemara says in Ksuvos, when do you have a dollar? It says a zuz, but if you, when is a dollar worth a dollar? If you take, you know, because if you have 100 pennies in your pocket, it doesn't do anything, it doesn't help you. But you give this money away to charity, you just got 100 pennies worth of tzedakah. You just got money out of that. You've gotten value out of it. In your pocket, it doesn't do anything. If you give to something spiritual, then it has meaning. Okay, so the best way to use physical things is to use it for charity and good deeds. And God will then assure the blessing. Hashem Yishmerecha. The second blessing is Ya'er Hashem Panav Elecha V'yichunecha. God illuminate His countenance upon you and be gracious to you. V'yichunecha, be gracious to you. May you find favor in the eyes of others. So says the Sifri. Others say that it means that you should find favor and grace in the eyes of God. Because if we give to others, then God will give us the grace that people should respect us and look up to us. Ramban interprets that it means finding favor in the eyes of God. And the third blessing is, Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha V'yichunecha, God lift up His face to you and establish peace for you. So Rashi says, may God suppress His anger. Because if you act appropriately, God will show you blessing and deny His anger, suppress His anger, and not punish you for doing wrong. Okay. Then we have the parsha. Up until now, these are things which are pretty well known. Now we're going to deal with a more esoteric aspect of our parsha. The parsha itself is 176 verses. And the reason that it's so long is the seventh chapter of Naso, the seventh chapter of Bamidbar, which falls in Naso, is overwhelmingly detailed 12 identical gifts that the 12 Nasim, the 12 tribal princes, brought. Now, instead of describing each one gift and saying the rest were the same, it goes out and describes each gift, even though each one of the other princes brought the exact same gift. Nonetheless, it's a repeats and full description of the gifts. The 12 leaders brought again and again and again, 12 times over. Therefore, this chapter is no less than 89 verses in length. But, as Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald points out, there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from this as well. That's why we have to say it 12 times again and again. It was the very first day of Nisan, the first year after the exodus from Mitzrayim, and on that day, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was consecrated. Every one of the princes brought their own gifts in celebrating this very momentous occasion. So Torah tells us, we have this in Perek Zayin Pasuk Gimel, that means the third verse in the seventh chapter, it teaches us the following. I read in English. They brought their offering before God, 6 covered wagons and 12 oxen, a wagon for each 2 leaders and an ox for each, and He brought them before the tabernacle. Okay. So, take this gift from them. That's already the fifth pasuk. Take from them, and they shall be to perform the work of the tent of meeting. You shall give them to the Levim, each man according to his work. Take this gift from them. And the way they'll do this is they'll be schlepped in the wagons, and each man according to his work. So the Medrash points out that the language which says, kach mitam, take it from them, meaning that Moshe Rabbeinu was rather reluctant to accept these gifts from them. Why was he reluctant? What was the problem? There were inhibitions all around. So the rabbi suggests Moshe was hesitant because the prince's gifts had been not divinely authorized. They brought them on their own accord. Now, the last time we had a gift that was brought without divine sanction was by Nadav and Avihu. And that resulted, they brought inappropriate gift into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and they died because of this. Moshe was very scared to touch this again. They died from a strange fire. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is that Moshe felt it was inappropriate that all of these gifts should be schlepped to the tabernacle in a wagon, schlepped by an ox. Rather, it would have been more respectful had they brought these gifts by hand. Some say that even the Nesim themselves, the princes themselves, felt that they were being a little bit disrespectful carrying these holy utensils in the wagons, and it would have been better better had they taken themselves by hand. That's why the Pasuk says, Kach me'itam, take it from them. It's indeed a very worthy gift and very appropriate for my sanctuary. So here's a lesson here. This is a very important lesson. It is disrespectful to transport the heavy planks of the tabernacle and the coverings. Pardon me, would it be considered disrespectful to take the heavy construction items of the tabernacle, the planks, and a wagon? If you think that would be disrespectful, what about taking them on Levim's shoulders? What about them? That would be disrespectful. To have men schlepping these things when it could be carried in a wagon that's pulled by an ox, that would be disgrace to man. And God fully agrees with this. That's not the way it should be done. There's no doubt. The most holy articles of the ark, the most holy utensils, meaning the menorah, the candelabra, the table for the showbread, the golden and the brass altars, those would be more properly taken, and they were taken indeed, on the shoulders of the Levim. But the heavy items, the pillars, the columns, the planks, the bases, the cords, the curtains, they were all moved by wagon. And God himself confirms the decision to take them by wagon. Why is it obvious that it was... how did the Nesi'im, how did the tribal leader, how did Moshe know that it was permissible to take it by wagon? Maybe it was disrespectful and they should have schlepped it by hand on their shoulders? And the answer is that common sense is not always so common. God says, Kach me'itam. What he's saying in effect is that this is in no way a diminution. No way are you diminishing God's honor. No way are you diminishing the honor of the holy utensils by transporting them in wagons. Because God's dignity, you know, people talk a lot about tzar balechayim. You have to be careful not to hurt an animal, which of course is true. And how much more so not to hurt a human? So here's the common sense over here, and God is affirming this. The common sense is God's dignity is intimately connected to human dignity. It's a greater honor to transport utensils by wagon, because that's going to promote the dignity of man. And therefore, it's appropriate they should be taken by wagon. Kach me'itam, go by wagons. So let's just quickly review the major things we have in our parsha, which are, we have the din of a sota, a woman who is an unfaithful wife. There is no proof one way or the other. But God Dafka wants to prove this with a miracle and erasing his holy name. And here we see the great lesson of peace. God is willing to allow even his holy name to be erased to maintain peace between husband and wife and that family harmony for the purpose of peace. So if God can allow his ineffable name to be erased, his lesson for all of us, how important we have to extend ourselves on behalf of peace. The rabbis say in the Gemara Brachos that if you dream about the following three things, it is an auspicious omen that you'll be blessed with peace. And they are a river, a bird, and a pot. Why these three? So I heard from Rabbi Lev that why a river? A river is a very beautiful thing. Bring things upstream, downstream, goes gurgle, gurgle, gurgle. It's very beautiful. However, that's as long as the river is within its banks. But once it begins to overflow, I remember 11 years ago when the mighty Mississippi overflowed and I called my friend in St. Louis. He answered the phone, blah, 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 blah. And he was in the attic, not in the basement. Then once it overflows its banks, it's not beautiful anymore. That's when you have chikuch and you have machlokas. You have to know where is your place and not to go over the banks of your place and go and step on someone else's toes and to trespass someone else's territory. That's why a river. Why a bird? Because a bird is a very agile creature. Doesn't like it above, flies below. Doesn't like it below, flies above. It's not so restricted and regimented. It has little mobility. To avoid machlokas and strife and argument, you can't be so rigid with your heels dug into the ground. You have to be a little elastic and move around. That's a good way to promote peace. Not always say, you're sitting in my place, you're taking my thing. Too. So many people, road rage. I just saw a statistic, and I don't remember if it was in Israel or America. It must be in America. 228,000 people die a year in accidents which are connected to road rage. People, if you just be able to... Okay, so he cut you off. The person has no derech eretz, he drives like a maniac, but you get yourself all worked up, and then you want to cut him back, or you act in a very own way that's not a safe driver, look what happens. You have to be a little elastic a little bit to accept an insult. And that's a way to avoid argumentation. Like a bird, doesn't like here, goes over there, doesn't like it there, goes down here, goes up there. And why a pot? This already is a chassidish of art. Because the pot is the ultimate shalomach, the ultimate peacemaker. It can bridge between fire and water. Sometimes it gets far schwarzed in the process, it gets black in the process, But it's certainly worth it if it can make peace between two warring objects, fire and water, the fire in the water in the pot and the fire underneath. So therefore, these three omens, these three things to dream about are an omen for peace. Okay, we also have in our parsha, we have the sota, and then if you see it, you should become a nazir. Accept upon yourself a vow, lest you have to see this grotesque scene and have a cynical reaction. They must have enjoyed themselves. Or you see the consequence of too much wine, so therefore take upon yourself right away that you're going to abstain from wine for a short period of time. And even though it is diminishing pleasure from this world, it's good to always make a, it's more important to make a boundary upon yourself, a fence not to violate something which could lead to greater sin. As Rabbi Lev pointed out, we see in our parsha, it's really based on the Sforno, that small things can be very significant. The Medrash also says, I think the Sforno brings this, that the Ksil, the fool, looks at all this learning behind, look at all those Sforno, all these books, says, how could I ever learn? It's too much. I'll never do it. A clever person says, listen, it's a lot of learning, but I'll learn a Perek today and a Mishnah tomorrow. And day after day, more and more and more. And you master everything. It is great, but a small thing at a time, you can master everything. Small things can be very significant. Bnei Gershom, raise them, Bnei Gershom. Even though they're lifting, they're carrying the items which are not so sanctified, not as holy as their brother Kahas, they're also part of the Jewish nation. Everyone has a part. Your part is to ask a question, someone else's portion is to answer a question. We're all important. Everyone is significant. The lesson of our parsha.